gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 5, the review segment, part 1. It is Tuesday, December 24th, 2013. As you might guess by the date, we are all off with our families in various places. So we're doing something a little different this week. We're going to have 2 reviews today, 1 today and 1 on Friday. And we're going to start off with The Wolf of Wall Street, which you may have heard all of us chattering about on Twitter and obliquely in the podcast before. But the embargo is lifted. We're allowed to talk about it. And joining me and Patches and David is Matt Singer. Matt, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
You can be found at The Dissolve and only these days. That is your only outlet.
That's right.
Well, he's also on Film Spotting SVU, which is a podcast everyone who listens to Fighting in the War Room also listens to.
That's very true.
Yeah, right.
I've sincere doubt that you'd be listening to this and not listening to SVU, but if you're not, you should fix that. And The Dissolve has had some really good year-end coverage, though, again, I bet anyone listening to this knew about that. So, read it if you haven't.
Keep complimenting me. I'm not going to say anything.
I know.
Yeah, I like that. I like how you fizzled out there. Well, a year in endings of your sentences.
I just want everyone to be aware of all the year-end material that is out there for you. I mean, Matt, we're complimenting you because I think we've brought you in to fight with you. There's been we've all talked about Wolf of Wall Street amongst ourselves, and David has already put it on his end of the year montage. A lot of people have seen. I've written a review of it, but Matt, I hear that you are less enamored with The Wolf of Wall Street than many, many other people. And I guess we should set up a little bit what it's about.
Yeah, what is it about?
Yeah.
Tell me.
Is it an actual wolf? Is this a Pixar?
Well, there is
film?
An actual CGI lion at the beginning.
Leonardo DiCaprio plays Jordan Wolf.
he plays Scott Wolf.
On Wall Street.
It's a street built on a wall.
He's a stray animal who's taken in by a stock trader.
Mm-hmm.
And then raised as if he was a human.
I like this
and
movie.
And then when he, yeah, and he has, so he's kind
it
of.
Sounds
he
kind
has,
of like Nell, like a male
yeah,
Nell.
Yeah. Male Nell. That's what it is.
That's the alternate title. okay. So Wolf of Wall Street, based on Jordan Belfort's memoir, True Story of How This Guy, like, started off by selling shitty penny stocks out of Long Island. Started this firm called Stratton Oakmont in the late 80s, or I guess really early 90s, and did all of the horrible things that we expect from Wall Streeters, and probably more horrible than you've ever imagined. I'm not imaginative enough to think of some of the horrible things that he does throughout this movie. And it's a rise and fall story, but it's a rise and fall story told by Martin Scorsese, the man who made Goodfellas. And there's already some significant online debate going on about the reprehensible behavior, and if that means that the movie doesn't back down on it enough, and whether or not you can actually stomach spending all this time with these people. But you've got Leonardo DiCaprio acting like a crazy person, Jonah Hill acting like a crazy person, and this crazy cast behind them. We've got Rob Reiner and John Bernthal and John Favreau's in one scene for a minute, and Margot Robbie, who is his ex-model wife, who's actually really funny in it and is in much more of it than I expected. So yeah, it's kind of the debaucherous, insane party of the year that you can choose to join in on and, or not. And Matt, now is when I get to throw to you and you tell me what you thought of Wolf of Wall Street.
Well, I liked the movie. It's not that I didn't like it. I think it's good. I enjoyed it. But I mean, it didn't make, you know, my year-end list or anything like that. It's difficult because I certainly know that the movie was delayed. You know, it was supposed to come out, I think, in like mid-November originally, and then it got pushed back to Christmas. So it's probably totally unfair of me to like use that knowledge as I'm watching it. But it did feel to me, it just felt a little incomplete to me. It felt like it felt a little rushed in terms of it, a little unpolished. Like, it seemed a little long and just not quite as perfect as I sort of would have liked it to be.
I think the movie runs, what, 2 hours and 45 minutes?
59.
Two hours and 59. Yeah.
And it was supposed to be 4 hours when it was.
Well, not supposed to be anything.
Or there was a cut of 4 hours.
Yeah. I mean, it's Scorsese's longest film, longer than Casino by, I think, about a minute.
Yeah. And it, I mean, it did, to me, it did feel kind of long. And the argument you can definitely make in favor of it, and I'm sure one of you guys will, is that, you know, it's a movie about excess and these people doing these horrible things. And sometimes to make a movie about excess, you have to make an excessive movie. And I can see that. I can definitely see that. And certainly the excessiveness does add certain things to the movie, but I almost feel like you might have gotten a more excessive impact out of the movie if it was maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes shorter and tighter, perhaps.
I don't disagree with any of the things you're saying about it being shorter or tighter. There are some scenes that go on for far too long, like far even in a movie that's interested in making you uncomfortable by having these scenes go on too long. They lose their impact by lasting as long as they do.
Can you cite?
One I'm thinking of in particular is when Jonah Hill and John Bernthal are standing in the parking lot of a diner screaming at each other. Mm. And the scene kind of is at the same register for a really long time and nothing actually happens until all of a sudden it happens. And it feels like it was a bunch of improv and they couldn't get out of the scene to where they needed to go without leaving it all.
That's exactly how I feel. There's another scene where Leonardo DiCaprio, Jonah Hill, and a couple of their suits are having a conversation about hiring a for-rent midget who they're going to throw on a dartboard, like a Velcro dartboard. And, I mean, the scene must be 5 minutes long where they're just talking about it and they're, like, making what seems to be improv jokes about, like, all the intricacies of the rental process for this midget. And I'm just like, what the hell? I mean, it's kind of funny, but, like, it's so... There's just so much riffing. I couldn't wrap my mind about why these scenes have to be in the movie.
Plays into a longer argument, but I think the point of the scene is really
how much longer.
Funny at first. I think it is eventually that scene, which I can assure you is based off of improvisation, is eventually horrifying. I mean, it's terrifying stuff to see how thoroughly convinced they are of. Removed from what it is they're actually talking about and how dehumanized they like how the extent to which they've dehumanized these little people, Matt Patches. The improvisation, for what it's worth, is, I think, and this is true of pretty much every scene in the film, brilliant. So I certainly – I've seen the film twice now and I would see it a third time. I was not bored
I wasn't bored. I just think those scenes, I mean, I understand what you're saying, that it has to be relentless so they seem removed from what they're talking about and just stuck in their own world and in their own groove. But some things just crossed a line. They still managed to go too far, or not too far, but too long, and they were too stuck in it. But I'm mostly with, I guess all of us kind of agree that it's a very funny movie and it's a very, it accomplishes its goal of making this character, Jordan Belfort, this enormous asshole who goes to great lengths to spend his money and show his power and prove himself at the top of the, to be the wolf of Wall Street, to be the king. And I think it makes its point by, as Matt Singer said, excessive excess. But it's thoroughly entertaining to just see how he climbed the ranks. It's, he really did start at the bottom. He's not exactly a self-made man, but he's mostly a self-made man. And I thought that was really interesting. I was on board to see his entire arc, you know, this fall of the king kind of thing. And it needs to be epic because he is the modern day king.
Although I feel like so much of the film's staying power and its truth and resonance for me is in his decline, in that it's not a traditional rise and fall story, but rather a accelerated rise and certainly an excessive one, as you said. But not quite the fall that we would expect. I don't want to – spoil is the wrong word for a story like this, but I don't want to necessarily reveal exactly where the movie goes. But it's not a fall in any sort of traditional variety.
Although I thought it was imbalanced.
I'm very clear about that, especially as far as its dynamic with the audience is concerned.
I don't think it was balanced in that way. I thought there was a lot of buildup and maybe not enough of that back end of more of how the government is kind of ripping him in two and really putting their nose in all of his business and the great lengths he went to protect themselves. I still feel like I have a few questions unanswered in this man's story, and I wish there might have been a little more later.
Like what?
In the film.
What do you need to have answered for you?
I guess I just wanted more of his conflict with Kyle Chandler's government agent. I just like the characters, and I like how they're facing off, and I like how he goes to protect himself. I just like that aspect of it.
So you like the plottedness of it, like kind of the more like traditional FBI guy after the bad guy. Like, not saying that, like, you want a traditional movie, but, like, that is probably the strongest plot thread in the movie, and it does kind of flip
maybe
in
and,
out
and it really it really provokes the addict in Jordan Belfort. You know, it's not just that he throws extravagant parties and does coke out of whores' asses and, you know, has dominatrix
excuse me
yes. Yes. Midget prostitutes midget whores.
He's administering the cocaine to her asshole.
Stuffing coke.
I mean, the gaffes coming out of your mouth right now are – it's impossible to take your argument seriously.
Well, I'm trying to get a job on Wall Street, so I'm
this
speaking
the
speak.
This is the Benghazi of Wolf of Wall Street reviews patches.
I'm the Duck Dynasty, yeah.
I mean, if you do want the like a more heavily plotted, you know, kind of – the guy versus the other guy sort of situation. You're not going to get that here. I mean, it is an excessive movie. There is a lot of stuff here, but there actually isn't that much of the conflict with Kyle Chandler's FBI agent. And I wasn't timing it, but I would wonder where in the movie he has his first line, because we see him.
It's got to be at least an hour in, because they only have one title card that says like 6 months later. That kind of propels the story forward into plot mode.
The whole idea of the story is not simply that we
tell me what I have to understand.
Told it, but we're being told it. Jordan is telling it to us. We are on the other end of this conversation. We are on the other end of the phone. You know, the pivotally unshown characters that they're calling. We are being told this conversation. We are only going to feel the long arm of the law when he does, and he is completely inured to it because of his excess and his drugs and his addiction to adulation and all these other things. And it's only when Kyle Chandler and the FBI guys really start to fuck with him that he would feel it and feel as if he
right.
is in some way fallible and vulnerable.
And I'm saying that in the back half of the movie, there feels like gaps. There feels like opportunities to see Jordan kind of pushed off the deep end by these guys, have their interference and see that provoke the same behavior and even more dangerously, even more violent. You know, he ends up encountering a lot of conflict and he escapes to Quaaludes and he escapes to cocaine and he escapes to sex with women. And we get a lot of that in the beginning, and it's good buildup. Like, I need the foundation that he has these vices. We need to see this. But we get a lot of it in the beginning. And I think I was more intrigued by when people are pushing against him and he's retreating to these things, as opposed to when he's just demonstrating his value in life by driving Ferrari and, you know, snorting cocaine or smoking crack or something like that, you know?
Go on, Matt.
I was just going to say, I think it's what you were saying, David, is totally fair, that it is told very explicitly from his perspective. And that explains to a large extent why there isn't as much of it. I'm not saying, you know, that you're wrong. I'm just saying it's not necessarily good or bad. I'm just sort of laying it out there that that's what it is. Like, if you want a more plotted movie, it's just not that. There's that, you know, and maybe that contributes to the feeling that it is so kind of long and expansive, is that it doesn't really have a very strong kind of narrative drive forward. After, I think some of the early scenes do, when he's sort of building his empire, it has sort of a propulsive energy. Like, those scenes are really great, but then once he's sort of at the top, you're right, it does take a long time before the FBI begins to kind of close in, and you feel that. And I think maybe that's where it did start to feel like it was sort of wandering, not always unpleasantly, but just
not unpleasantly.
Because
I mean, the performances at the end of the day, I don't need to be plot driven to enjoy a movie like this, because the performances are so good. I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio is running on all cylinders here, and he's going crazy, and he can throw himself into physical comedy bits where he is on Quaaludes and can't control his body and he's flopping around like Jim Carrey, or he can be, you know, at the end of his mental state, his divorces and his women in his life, and the FBI's looking down his throat.
We're saying that scene that you referenced, where he is, I don't want to say too much, but he's flopping.
Where he's flopping.
Takes a lot of Quaaludes. I mean, I think, this is hyperbole, and I
I don't know. Off the top of my head, I cannot think of a funnier scene I've ever seen in a movie.
I'm almost with you. I think I said the other day that it reminded me of Jim Carrey coming out of the rhinoceros's ass in Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls, which is the funniest thing.
That is
high praise from me.
It's a perfect example. I remember how old I was when I saw that, and you know, I'd not sure if it had the same effect on me now, but I remember, like, honestly almost being asphyxiated. I was laughing so hard, and this is exactly like that. I mean, it is far and away my favorite scene in a movie this year. It topped film.com's list of the
there you go. But luckily too that the supporting actors in this movie are ready to bounce off Leonardo DiCaprio. Mm-hmm. You know, I actually don't think Jonah Hill, I mean, he gets lost a little bit in this movie for me. He doesn't really stand out as kind of an amazing performance or someone that's really adding a lot to the texture of this film. I actually think that some of the other, I mean, smaller supporting roles, these guys who are just all they're on the journey the entire time from the penny stocks until they grow into this enormous empire. Guys like PJ Byrne, who he's just plays this kind of like nerdy guy, glasses, and he's just along for the ride, and he gets sucked into the glamour of Wall Street, and he's always by Leonardo DiCaprio's side making some funny quip or just telling the truth. I don't know. He's just very funny.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned him at the top, but Rob Reiner is in like his three scenes as Jordan Belfort's dad, and he's really funny. And you do get the feeling that people like him and John Bernthal and Jean Dujardin were in the movie more before it got trimmed down to this extent. And I do miss, I am curious about the 4.5 hour cut of this that has more of them.
I feel like there must be more Jonah Hill.
Yeah, well, I've spoken a little bit to some of the people who are involved in the editing, and I was speaking to Thelma Schumacher tomorrow. I wish I talked to her already.
Me too.
A better answer. Maybe we can talk to her together. Get her on the podcast. My impression is that it was really just about – I mean, I'm sure there are some scenes that are gone entirely, but I was talking to Margot Robbie today, and there was – she was talking to me that like 10 minutes of the scene where she is in the nursery sort of teasing Leonardo DiCaprio was cut, and a lot of improvisation. The scenes were just sort of trimmed down, not unlike one of Matt Singer's beloved Adam McKay movies, I would imagine.
If you don't love Step Brothers, you step off.
No, I love Step Brothers like I love few people on this earth. But there are I think a lot of it was less people having reduced roles because of scenes that were cut, and more just tightened scenes that are in the final film.
The scene in question that I really think you could probably describe. I don't think there's really any way to spoil it, but whatever. We'll keep it quiet. I mean,
it's always
the scene that you so strongly compared to Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls. You didn't even compare it to the original Ventura, which is absurd.
Which is very funny.
Ace
but
Ventura
I'm telling
when
you,
Nature Calls has the best scene.
That rhino scene to this day. I mean, until I saw this scene, I really didn't think there was anything physical comedy wise comparable since then. I truly.
Well, I'm sure Leonardo DiCaprio would appreciate,
he really appreciate
his
it.
Triumph to a Jim Carrey sequel. But
he'll mention it as Oscar acceptance.
Yes.
Yeah, that scene, I mean, it is incredible. It's really, really – you're being hyperbolic in one of the strangest ways I've ever heard. But it's worthy of comparisons to great scenes anyway. It's this movie's like you know, the helicopter scene in Goodfellas with, you know, stirring the gravy and all that. Like, it's that scene for this movie, just in terms of how incredible and hilarious and kind of also exciting it is. But it, I think it also, I mean, again, I wasn't timing it, and I'd be curious to know how much more of the movie is after that scene, because it seemed to me like after that, there was no topping that scene. And like it almost should have come maybe later in the movie. Like it's hard to come down from that scene and have a
oddly
lot
enough
movie.
That scene is so funny that they have to flash back to it.
But, oh, well, they do.
With the flashback to it, it's not like remember when we said this? I mean, it's like
it kind of is.
Layers the scene and is hilarious.
It kind of is like that because it's an extension of the scene in a way. I just think it's funny. Just like the priority to stack this movie with so much stuff. Like you have to go back to the scene. And
it's
just
like
keep
a
going.
Mini movie that because there's the scene and then you think it's over, but then it tops itself with this incredible
confrontation between Jonah Hill and Leonardo DiCaprio. But, and then it goes back and there's icing on the cake and it's like this whole self-contained
Singer, you're absolutely right. Like that part of the movie is it just all kind of glosses until the end there. And I'm fascinated by what happens to Jordan Belfort after this is again when the IRS really kind of sticks their nose in his business. It's not that important. It's a movie of moments and the moments are very funny. But when it starts being interesting in the dynamic between these different entities, it doesn't really hold. It doesn't really stick.
I really couldn't disagree more. I think that's when the movie is most fascinating. I think when you see how little he actually has, how quickly these relationships build onto Upshur.
Then I think it's important
how he's reduced and what it and that speed. I mean, the key moment of the movie is not the Quaalude scene, which is the best moment of the movie. But the key moment of the movie is when you realize just how addicted to this adulation he is. When he is giving the speech to you think he's taking a deal with the SEC and is going to step down. And in the middle of this speech where he's self-aggrandizing and having this woman who looks exactly like Jenna Elfman, if it's not Jenna Elfman. I don't think it was Jenna Elfman.
I do not believe it's Jenna.
It's like her sister. He's like, tell everyone how great I am. And then he just can't leave. I mean, that's the heart of the movie, and that is well after the Quaalude scene.
You know what scene I've thought about a lot, and I don't want to get like super specific because people haven't seen it, but the shipwreck scene, which when I was watching it, all I could think about was how expensive it was because that is a crazy scene. And at the time,
at least you were emotionally invested in the movie to the point where you were thinking about the budget.
Well,
that's good.
I've spent the whole movie like marveling at all the excess that's there, and you know, you're just like thinking, you know, you're thinking about money and overindulgent. And it kind of felt like at the time I was like, did they really need this scene? Like, did it have to be so insane? And that scene has stuck with me so much, and I feel like I've only seen it once. It was a couple weeks ago, so I haven't had a time to absorb it the way that you have, David. But I think the way that stuff piles on top of each other really has this impact. So then you walk out of it and a week later and you feel the impact of what all that addition meant more than you can really realize when you're just being bombarded with this a lot of movie.
you could almost make this movie three times for what it costs to make 47 Ronin, I'm just saying.
I don't think you're allowed to talk about this movie yet.
That scene on the yacht, I mean, it's another great scene, but, you know, I would compare it probably favorably to, like, the end of the Cable Guy. I mean, if we're going to, you know, the Jim Carrey thing, just keep
yes.
going. It's like,
yes.
I insist that you say it, Cable Guy.
Cable Guy.
The scene on the satellite dish, absolutely. Or maybe something from, I don't know, I'm trying to think.
I'm going to compare it to
Simon Birch. It's like a great scene from Simon Birch.
It's really like the end of The Majestic, I think.
Look, 15 years ago, Jim Carrey could have played Jordan Belfort.
Oh, my God.
Leonardo DiCaprio apparently can play 23-year-olds for the next 30 years. So
well,
he does not
age. Did you
really
buy him as a 23?
Yes, I do. It blows my mind.
It is actually surprising.
I buy it completely.
He's got that.
That's another one of the scenes that goes on. Like, I don't even know half of what Matthew McConaughey said in that entire scene, and like, I don't really care. Because it's amazing.
He's giving like a Tony Robbins motivational speech.
Sure, but do you remember any specifics of what he said?
How about
just that? Yeah, just the song.
It's great.
Song.
He talks about how many times he masturbates a week. And
that's true.
That's the waiter bringing him drinks every 7.5 minutes and the Fugazis.
Terrence Winter deserves some credit here for coming up with some perverse poeticism in this movie with the masturbation talk or even like the dialogue about, you know, at some point Jordan stumbles upon a gay orgy taking place in their apartment, and then he's scolding their housekeeper, and it's just like what's coming out of their mouths is so foul, it's so disgusting, it's so morally reprehensible, but it's so entertaining
really
to listen to.
I think Matthew McConaughey, the Academy may not share my view that James Franco should win Best Supporting Actor, but I think Matthew McConaughey should be nominated. He's in two scenes, but really only one in this film. And it is so amazing. It's so much more interesting than anything he does in Dallas Buyers Club. That's a
shit. Pretty good in Dallas Buyers Club.
He is good,
but he's not as like. I don't think he's as compelling and interesting. And he leaves such a mark on this whole movie to the point where he actually colored the production. I mean, like, he improvised all that shit with the beating as hard as you see in the trailer. And that comes back in a major, major way later in the film. And I think really sort of functions as a through line through it. I think he contributes so much to this movie in the one scene.
I think
you're
high on this movie.
As a supporting actor.
Yeah.
You're addicted to this film.
You're selling McConaughey and Dallas Buyers Club a little short. I mean, that's like, it was like his Mr. Popper's Penguin.
I
mean, that
was. I was trying to find a Jim Carrey.
I'll give you McConaughey and Dallas Buyers Club, but I will not give you Dallas Buyers Club itself.
No, the movie itself isn't that great. But I mean, he's doing an incredible, incredible job in it. I want to say one thing that I did like about The Wolf of Wall Street. I like the movie. Like I'm, you've cast me as the role.
Sorry,
of,
I know. I cast you as the dissenter, and I was.
I know. I've been cast as Kyle Chandler.
Yeah, you're the Kyle Chandler of this podcast.
Get off my yacht, Matt.
I'm gonna throw lobsters at you.
I know. I'm the buzzkill here, and that's fine. I'm happy to play the role. But one thing I did like about the movie that we haven't mentioned is, you know, and obviously the movie's coming out now so close to American Hustle, which was another movie that I actually enjoyed. But the one thing that really bugged me about that movie, and I think I might have said it to – I can't remember if I saw it with some of you guys. I might have even said this. I don't remember at the time. But like everyone in that movie is acting like they're on cocaine, but there's no cocaine use. So they're just kind of acting crazy, especially Bradley Cooper. We see him use coke one time in the movie, but over the course of the movie, he becomes increasingly irrational and bizarre and crazy and manic. But we never see him using any drugs. And it just kind of bothered me that they were like sort of like there was all this like implied drug use just by their behavior. But they didn't have it almost felt kind of like they kind of wussed out on the drugs. Maybe I don't know. I don't know if it was a rating issue or what, but that kind of drove me crazy about that movie. There's no like they don't shy away from it. They don't pretend. They kind of like shove your face right in all of the illicit substances, which I sort of like respect about it. I guess some people have. You were alluding to earlier, like complaining that the people are so.
I do want to hear people's whatever, but opinions on that a little bit. That if this movie is condemning the behavior as much as it should, or something like that. I've seen
it's
a couple
funny.
People
tweeted,
retaliating
I,
against that.
I tweeted something that I'm remembering now because I tweeted it at Matt Singer, who is now joining us on this podcast.
Who's that?
Whoa!
And, which I said about The Wind Rises, and I realized last night that I think that the arguments are similar between those two films. They have a lot in common. Where it's a lot easier for people to. Ask for morally complex films than it is to appreciate them. And I understand that it sounds horribly condescending, and it's less so when you're not channeling it in any one person in particular. But I think that, you know, people that watch this movie and say that they can't understand it as an indictment against Jordan Belfort because there's not a scene where he looks in the camera and he goes, like, I have such greed, like Meryl Streep, and he's freaked out. they've forgotten how to watch movies. I just don't understand. I just don't understand. I read that article in The Wire. I read David Denby's review. You're not watching the movie.
I think what's tricky about this movie is not that I don't think it does have moral judgment against more about Jordan Belfort. I think it's actively uninterested in morality. You've got Kyle Chandler's character who is a moral figure, but as you see what happens to him in the end, he's kind of afloat in a world that has no need for it. I feel like Scorsese looking at actual Wall Street, actual things that have happened to Jordan Belfort and other people who fucked up the entire economy and saying the world doesn't have a moral judgment on them, so I'm not going to either, and I'm going to present it. And in his way, and I feel like I need to see it again to understand exactly how this happens. You see the disgustingness right alongside the excess, but there's no stepping outside to truly judge it because that's not how the world works.
Yeah, you have to be seduced by him for the film to work. I mean, as I said before, like we – and it's the last scene of the film hammers this home very clearly. You know, you really have to be seduced by him to understand his appeal and how this could have happened to him and to those around him. And I think the fact that a lot of the guys who perpetrated these things are still doing just fine for themselves, like Jordan Belfort, who stands to gain upwards of $15 million for this movie, that even if there is a certain moral recrimination against them, like they're still rich. I mean, like there's this line at the end of the movie where he's in prison. He's like, and then I remembered that I am still fucking rich. And even though things, you know, took a shit for him, the penalty for certain crimes is just not what it should be. But I certainly don't think and I think part of the value of the movie and part of its effect is that there is going to be a faction of people who watch this movie and say, Oh man, I want to be this guy. I want to have those things, but it's not the film's problem.
I don't think anyone who goes to see this movie is going to think that. Unlike Spring Breakers, that can convince the wrong audience and be subversive in that way with iconography of the youth culture.
Look at what happened to Scarface. I mean, I think this is
true.
You know, Scarface for the white collar set.
Although it's true, I want to do Quaaludes now. Like, I need to calm down.
But you can't. You can't. They are gone.
It's you know, I hadn't thought about this before, but just hearing David describe the movie in these terms, it does kind of mirror the article that's written about Jordan Belfort in the movie, right? Like, they outline all these horrible things he does, and what happens? All these people show up to work at his his firm. It's a complete hit job about him. It doesn't hide his flaws. It doesn't show, like, you know, it's not a rose colored portrait at all. And yet the net result is it actually helps him and, like, increases his business. So in a sense, the movie does exactly the same thing. It doesn't shy away for even a second from all of the horrible things he did, you know, like in his business or otherwise. And yet at the end of the movie, people are coming out of it. I didn't really feel this way, but apparently people do that. The movie is like valorizing him or encouraging people to get into the stock market. So
I wish I knew more about how
the point, because it's like the headline of that article is The Wolf of Wall Street.
And then, Wall Street,
and then the people in his office repurpose that and start chanting like Wolfie, Wolfie. As the movie goes on, it becomes like a nickname for him.
Yeah. But he just doesn't have a scene where he goes, I was the Wolf of Wall Street. And now I've learned. The real Wolf of Wall Street was love.
I just want to know how stockbroker trading works. How do stocks work? I don't really.
The crazy thing is, at the very end, when he gets arrested by the FBI, I had no idea what he... I don't know what part of it was legal and what part wasn't. I have no clue.
But you don't have to. You just said,
I know,
you know,
it doesn't
that
matter.
You know that these people are criminals because they work.
I mean, how much do you know what that caused the financial crisis was and was not legal? Like, most of it was legal. Like,
most
it really
it was,
doesn't make a difference.
Most of it was much worse. And the problem is, there's people, you know, doing this with much greater stakes that were not simply amassing personal wealth, but, you know, gambling with bigger things. But the I mean, all you have to know is that it's all laid out in that scene with Matthew McConaughey, which again accomplished this so much, where he's saying, you know, you're taking money from their pocket and putting it to yours. And Leo's like, well, why don't we make them as money as well? And Matthew McConaughey just exposes the whole system of saying it's not even real money. It's all, you know. I'm just going to quote that whole scene now.
There are several times, though, where Leonardo DiCaprio actually, like, says he looks right into the camera and explains what he's doing, and it does, and we have no idea what he's talking about. Like, and I think that's also sort of the point, is that nobody except the people who are doing this understand what they're doing, and that's why it's so hard to sort of monitor them and why they can get away with this, is that it's like it doesn't make any sense to anybody, but they figured out a way to rook the system. And they can just do it while nobody is looking, or even when people are looking, because when they're looking, they have no idea. And I think he even has a line like that where he's explaining it to the camera and even says, you know what, it doesn't even matter, or something like that, where because he knows that we have absolutely no idea what he's talking about.
And yet it's like, so entertaining.
Penny stocks. I mean, it's like the people are trading stocks for 6 cents a share. And not only does no one know what they're talking about, but really nobody cares because they're all just postmen, you know, are buying things at 6 cents a share, these mom and pop companies. And, you know, that's
as long as it sounds good, they'll pay the money. Yeah.
So go take your family to Wolf of Wall Street. Good luck dealing with the snorting.
I was going to say, are you going to recommend going to see this with your family?
No, I would.
The family film of the Christmas season.
Yeah,
that highly would be uncomfortable. I know. Yeah. I think there are members of my family who would enjoy watching it. I'm just going to let them watch it by themselves.
Right.
Obviously go see it. It'll be very interesting. I know David hates it when I talk about awards, but it will be interesting to see.
I
how
already
the conversation
talked about awards
shifts.
In this conversation.
I don't know. I feel like I went to see Titanic with my mom, and I got to see Leonardo DiCaprio hook up with Kate Winslet in the back of a car and get all steamy. So I feel like I should go see Wolf of Wall Street with my mom, because now I finally see like a shadowy area of DiCaprio's crotch. Like, you can almost make out Shaft in this movie. And maybe this is like I'm older now and I can see with my mom. Mm-hmm.
It is a masterpiece akin to Ace Ventura: When Nature Calls.
Absolutely.
For sure.
Got Did anyone see Walking with Dinosaurs?
No. Oh.
That was my introduction to this.
Do you want to say that again?
No.
That does it for today's Fighting in the War Room. We'll be back on Friday talking about Saving Mr. Banks. Again, we hope you're all enjoying your holidays and not having to go into an office. It's very nice. In the meantime, tell the people who you are, starting with our guest, Matt Singer. Where can people find you on the internet?
Well, I'm the news editor of The Dissolve, and that's the
Not since Liar Liar have I heard someone choke over words. No, I like, we got to keep that.
We have to keep that.
That was beautiful. Yeah. That was
just
wonderful.
Just we're doing it live.
Oh, we'll do it live. So The Dissolve is thedissolve.com, and my podcast is Film Spotting SVU. That's at filmspottingsvu.com, and my Twitter handle is at Matt Singer.
And I am Matt Patches, writer of the internet, Jim Carrey in, I don't know what movie, Eternal Sunshine, I'm sad. No. A Man on the Moon. I'm mysterious.
Wonderstone vibe.
I'm going to put this needle through my cheek now. And you can find all my work at mattpatches.com, and I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on film.com and on Twitter at David Ehrlich and at film, DOTCOM.
And I'm Katie Rich. I am Jim Carrey of The Truman Show, and therefore I trust none of you, and I believe that you've all been hired to be my friends. You can find me at Vanity Fair's Hollywood and also on Twitter at Katie Rich, K-A-T-E-Y-R-I-C-H. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you on Friday.